Welcome to Political Rewind. Boy, it is a gloomy day here in Atlanta if you're listening to us in real time. It's been raining virtually the entire day across the city, and I checked the weather forecast for much of the rest of the state. You're getting rain in Savannah, I think. Down in Albany, you're getting rain. So I guess most of Georgia is struggling today with gloom. And Jim Galloway, there, depending on whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, there's some gloom among some more than others right now. We'll talk about that.
It's nothing that a fireplace wouldn't cure, you know?
That's Jim Galloway, of course. He's the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he was in our offices a little early today, already working on his Wednesday column. We're not going to give it away. We want people to read it.
That's right, yeah.
Either online at Politically Georgia or in the Dead Tree paper on Wednesday morning.
That's right.
All right. Mary Margaret Oliver, State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, a Democrat out in Decatur, is with us today. Mary Margaret, when I talked about gloom, if not a whole lot changes in the election outcomes, which we're going to look at in just a couple minutes, it's not a bright, sunshiny day for some Democrats in the state.
It's definitely a mix. It's definitely a mix. and it is not over.
We're going to watch, and we'll talk about that. Kyle Hayes is with us. He is the co-founder of Peach Pod, which is a terrific podcast that you can subscribe to hear all about Georgia politics. Kyle joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Hey, Kyle, how are you?
Doing great. It's great to be back.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. You're dropping a new Peach Pod on Thursday, you told me.
We are. We'll take a look at the ongoing discussion about these ramping up these election totals and the ouster of Jeff Sessions from the Department of Justice in D.C.
All right.
So look for that on Thursday.
All right. Thursday's Peach Pod. And Leo Smith is here with us in our studios. He's a longtime Republican strategist, spent a good amount of time working as the minority outreach director at the Georgia Republican Party. And Leo, it's a pleasure to have you as well. You've got a slightly sunnier outlook today than perhaps some of the Democrats.
Sure, absolutely. I can see from both sides now.
Oh, yeah. Why don't we just play Judy Collins?
We really don't know clouds at all, right?
Jim Galloway, let's get right to the races that we're still following 6 days after the election. We are still waiting for a final outcome to the Georgia governor's race. Brian Kemp appears to be at a point where he's already said he won the race. The governor has already anointed him the governor-elect. The Abrams people are saying not so fast.
Right, right. Let me see. I talked to a few of my Democratic friends this afternoon. They said there is still a path. I think I said earlier before we went on air, it is a footpath
for the governor's race.
In the governor's race for Abrams, there is still something. The latest AJC numbers we have put Brian Kemp at 50.27% of the vote, about 10,480 votes above the 50% threshold that he needs.
Well, and that in and of itself is an interesting number, because as of early in the weekend, I think it was a 20,000+ margin that he had over the 50%.
Right, right. We've got all these absentee ballots that are rolling in. These conditional ballots that are being counted in some cases, not in other cases. I think what we got to remember here is, I know you've got, you know, people in Brian Kemp's camp are calling, you know, they're just demanding that Stacey Abrams fold up her tent and go away. But this is the closest race for governor that we've had since 1966.
Sure, and I think this is also bigger than the issue of did I win. I think that she ran on the idea that she wanted every voter to be cherished, every vote to be cherished, every voter to be cherished, and she wants to make sure that every voter gets count. And I don't think that this is detached from what's happening with Gillum in Florida. And
no,
they feel that one county, if they can find several tens of thousands of votes in one county in Florida, perhaps they can find a few thousands of votes in certain counties here in Georgia.
So before we continue this conversation, which we will, let's listen to House Stacey Abrams described what she is working at with her team right now. She posted a video on Facebook yesterday. Here's what a little part of what she said.
We continue to fight because it's not whether I win or lose. I'd love to win. I want to win. But that's not the point. The point is that the system has to work. The point is we have to have confidence in that system, that our democracy is bounded together by our common belief that what we do matters, that our votes matter, and that every vote counts, no matter where you start, no matter how you think, no matter what you believe.
Mary Margaret, I think Leo said it too. She can't abandon the voters that she encouraged to come out now.
I'm a supporter, a financial supporter, a political supporter. She cannot abandon my support at this time. I've sat on the Government Affairs Committee for the last dozen years in the Capitol. We've changed the rules every year. We've gotten people engaged where over half of them vote early voting. We have eliminated any reason for absentee ballots, which means tens of hundreds of thousands of people are voting in fundamentally different ways. And they like it. And we are having closer and closer elections that with greater scrutiny. As you know, I've been following the litigation really closely on these cases because it matters. Discovery, traditional lawyer discovery. How many of the counties, 159 counties, are going to certify correct numbers by close of business tomorrow, which is their deadline? And every day, although Brian Kemp's website says 100% of the votes have been counted, every single day, if not every hour, the number changes. They have not been counted because the number changes. 48 hours ago, he was 20,800 up. Now he's 10,000 up.
Above the threshold for a runoff.
Yeah. Which is a big change over the weekend. But I'm looking at a lot of little races, too. I'm looking, even in my race, uncontested. Numbers change day to day.
Kyle, one of the interesting things about all of this is I don't want to go through all of it. I get confused about the lawsuits. That's why we have lawyers like Mary Margaret. But I think at the heart, Kyle, of the lawsuits is this insistence by Democrats, whether it's the Abrams campaign, the state Democratic Party, now Carolyn Bordeaux's campaign. At the heart of it is count every vote. The contention by the Democrats is that votes have been arbitrarily dismissed and need to be counted, right?
Right. And I think it's important that this process run through. I know the Kemp campaign is frustrated that this process continues on and that Abrams won't actually just concede in this race. But even if none of the outcomes are changed, it's important for these problems to come to light so that the legislature can address them. You know, they were criticized by Judge Amy Totenberg about having their heads in the sand about another aspect of our voting system, the security of our voting machines. And so I think all of this creates a good to-do list for the legislature to make sure our votes are accessible to everyone who is eligible to cast a vote.
As our science changes, as our political science changes, as our voters change, it's essential that we get this right. And we are not getting it right. And I think the voters understand that.
So, Jim, let's talk a little bit. All right, so we know that Abrams still needs 10,000 plus votes, but
just to make the runoff.
Right. The deadline for certifying is it, I think, the end of business tomorrow, although I don't know if the Secretary of State's office means midnight on Tuesday or whether it's business hours, but it's tomorrow.
Right. But one of these lawsuits that have been filed by the Abrams campaign or the Democratic Party, I can't remember which, is asking that that deadline be extended to Wednesday.
Right, to make sure that counties have the chance to include counts. And many of these challenges are over. In many cases, I'm even careful about how I characterize this, some kind of mismatches, whether it's a name, Mary Margaret, that whether the signature is a little bit different from the registration signature. A lot of it has to do with some kind of conflict between registration and voting record.
And the lawsuits are talking about arbitrary decisions that the election staffs are making in the 159 counties. Judge LeMay, in the lawsuit about the absentee ballots in Gwinnett County, was very clear that the electorate staff of Gwinnett County didn't have the expertise to decide what didn't look like a signature to them. I don't know what she said, Judge LeMay said, and it made me think for myself also. I don't know what my signature looked like when I registered to vote 50 years, excuse me, a good number of decades ago. And I don't think that deciding somebody's signature doesn't, quote, look right is a reason to deny the vote. There's the issue of the signature on the application. There's the issue of the signature on the ballot. And then we come, in addition to the large amount of technical errors being made or assessed to be made by people for reasons that I would like to question every single one of them about, then you have, I'm not sure how many provisional ballots that have not been counted, because last week, last Friday, today's only Monday, Brian Kemp wasn't releasing the number of provisional ballots that had been submitted. Another big mistake, if whether or not we can argue, we could argue surely that he's made mistakes in managing these elections, but now the political mistake that Brian Kemp is making, in my opinion, is he's still name-calling. What I mean is his secretary,
yeah,
press secretary, still name-calling.
I do want to talk about that. But before we get to that, Leo, and really it's a part of all that, Leo, we mentioned this on the show on Friday, but I think there's more to be said about it, especially since we've seen the numbers narrow a bit for Abrams and Kemp. Now, I think I can say somewhat safely that Brian Kemp's to lose this election. He does. It's going to be hard for Abrams to make up those 10,000 plus votes, probably.
Yes.
So Kemp is most likely on track, as he thinks he is. But you had the governor on Thursday, as you know, as a Republican, standing in his office with Kemp at his side, declaring him to be the winner of this election. Why do you imagine, did the governor do that because he felt he had to try to close the book on this as quickly as possible? Did he want to not have doubt lingering in the air? Did he act prematurely and lose some credibility because of it?
I think there are a number of possible forces that move the governor that way. One is, I mean, from a practical standpoint, he does have this looming meeting he needs to have. He needs to have session. And he wanted to have the next governor in on those meetings that are critical on large expenditures that will have to be outlaid related to the emergency storm and the emergency session call. The other thing is that, yes, I mean, he has an expectation as a Republican governor to have favor for the home team. And in this case, the Governor Deal having been what I would consider a pretty unifying governor, perhaps if we want to look in the best case scenario, he's going, I need to be the grandparent here. When the two parents are not getting along and making a good decision, then I, the grandparent, come in and I say, look, this is what y'all are going to do, and we need to get to peace. So he took it upon himself to say, okay, the legitimacy of the governor's seat is at stake, and I need to make sure that Kemp can lead with legitimacy.
Kyle, he also, I think, made it clear that he needs to get Brian Kemp, assuming he is going to be the governor, up to speed on
the budget,
right, Kyle?
Right, yeah. So they've got that on their to-do list. I think for the governor too, you're probably working off of Secretary Kemp's numbers, and he's been arguing throughout this entire process that it's not mathematically possible for the Abrams campaign to push this in a runoff, even if all the votes left went to her. But I think, at least according to the claims from Abrams, that seems to have changed, where the votes may be there if some of these new votes that she's saying were wrongfully not counted or wrongfully haven't been counted yet would potentially push it into a runoff, even if it's not likely. And so I think that may be why they moved on Thursday, but the story may be changing as we get.
I really think it is about the budget. I don't think that we're going to have a very detailed drill down discussion tomorrow.
Right.
I'm on the Appropriations Committee about the budget, and that's the governor's serious. He wants to control that. He wants to make sure his priorities are implemented. So I think part of it was the governor deal doing what he wants to do as a usual good job. But I want to come back to this name-calling business.
Can I make one clarification? The budget itself is not part of the special session. I just want to make sure our listeners know that. This emergency money.
It's $270 million in emergency
funds. In emergency funds. So go ahead.
But to the extent to which that becomes a relevant factor for me to vote on as an Appropriations Committee, it certainly matters what our surplus is and what our spending is and all of that. It's a serious matter, what happened in the storm, and it's a serious discussion. And I don't think Governor Deal, wants Brian Kemp to be totally isolated from that. But may I talk about this name-calling business?
Well, let me set it up a little bit, okay? So on Saturday, Brian Kemp declared that he was the new governor, and the governor confirmed that for people on Thursday. That's the point they made. Jim, let me get you and then go to Mary Margaret. On Saturday, the Kemp campaign put out a news release, and here's just some of the language. Radical Stacey Abrams refuses to accept the convincing results of the November 6th election. Days after businessman Brian Kemp earned a clear victory, Abrams and her, quote, left-wing backers, they're filing frivolous lawsuits. And then there's this quote from their communications director. Stacey Abrams and her radical backers have moved from desperation to delusion. And it's incredibly shameful that liberal lawyers are doubling down on lawsuits, desperately trying to create more votes for Stacey Abrams. They don't want to win this election. They're trying to steal it.
I think you're reading from Monday's, today's.
Right. That was Monday's.
Okay, you're absolutely right.
All right. It's pretty bad. On Saturday, they called it a disgrace to democracy.
And 2 days before that, hours after kind of Karen Handel left the field and allowed them to start railing against Abrams. I think it was, I can't remember the language, it was she was attempting to use the courts to steal an election.
Yeah.
Steal the election is the word I remember.
Yes.
Right. And so you've had this ratcheting up, and I will let, do you want to jump in
here? Yeah, why don't you go ahead, Mary Margaret, because this is truly upsetting to you.
It's a bummer. And, of course, the press secretary is the man who if he was employed by me, would have been fired when he said to another senator that Brian Kemp served with in the Senate, she's off her meds, she's mentally ill. Once you continue to employ somebody, you got to watch them closely. And this weekend, that same man is using terrible language about an incredibly respected professional and the court system. I saw Brian Kemp's press conference. I wanted to see how he presented himself. He read everything dutifully off the piece of paper in front of him. I had a little bit of sympathy when he said he'd only slept 2 hours in the last 48. I thought that could have been a true statement. But when he went off record, when he stopped, when his eyes came off the page and looked directly at the reporters, he wanted to talk about these ridiculous lawsuits. Now, is that an intentional Trumpism in his part, or does he really think that anybody who sues him over his malfeasance is being ridiculous?
All right, so, Leo, I need to get you in here because you're the Republican in the room. If you were a strategist on the Kemp campaign right now, would you advise them, since it is likely they are going to, you know, at this point, unless something happens that we're not anticipating, it is at least likely that they may end up in the governor's seat chair, that they ought to bring, you know, tone it down at this point, or no?
Well, I would advise them that they should tone it down. And I actually, knowing those people involved, from Ryan Mahoney, the press secretary, to Brian himself, I don't think that these are the best representations of who I think they are. I really don't. So I would think that this is a strategic decision that they made. And not being privy to those strategic conversations, I don't know why they're doing it the way they're doing it. But I think that these are people who are open to having a peaceful transition, to make sure they have a transition that includes a dignified approach that involves all Georgians. And so I'm a little surprised.
But
at the
Galloway knows why they're doing it, Leo, don't you, Jim?
Well, I have my suspicions. I have my suspicions.
Then explain it to me.
And first of all, you know, you're right. It's unusual language. It's not the language of confidence. If you're confident that your numbers are going to stick, that's not the kind of language you use. Number one, it's not there to persuade Stacey Abrams to concede.
I that's for sure. It's certainly not encouraging her, but I'm not sure the first part of that. I think maybe it's language you use when you know you're about to win and you feel you can get away with whatever
but
you want.
Here's the thing. To me, you have to remember that we've got a runoff. We've got two runoffs guaranteed. Even if we don't have one in the governor's office, we have Lindy Miller, Democrat, facing Republican incumbent Chuck Eaton in a PSC race. Plant Vogel is at the heart of that. And then we have the race to replace Brian Kemp as Secretary of State between Republican Brian Raffensperger and former Congressman John Barrow, the Democrat. And that's the one, I think, that if you're a Republican in the Capitol who wants to preserve the status quo, that's the race you have to win. And in order to do that, you have to keep your people angry and active.
But you know what else, Kyle? This language, interestingly, is an absolute mirror of what's going on in Florida right now. This is exactly the way the president talked about the Florida counting going on in Broward County, for instance, in Dade County over the weekend. This is what the Trump administration, you know, Trump is essentially saying they're counting every vote. What crooks? Kyle, it's a very direct comparison, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's even worse in Florida because the military and overseas ballots in Florida aren't due until the 16th. And Trump's tweet this morning was that the vote counting process needed to stop. This isn't the only option for Republicans, though. Rob Woodall told the AJC that he wanted to make sure that we're going to get every vote counted and that every issue is going to be resolved. And whatever that count turned out to be, he'd be happy with it. I don't think it's a good place for Kemp to have this fiery rhetoric at this point, because one of the things he said in Thursday's press conference was he wanted to lead on the issue of replacing the state's voting machines. And so you have a candidate right now who's being critical of the vote counting process, wanting to be the one whose central policy achievement next year is changing these voting machines and picking up what has already been done. I just don't think that this rhetoric contributes to him being successful.
Mary Margaret, I wonder if it's, to some strange extent, muscle memory. When you're fighting in a campaign, you start turning loose with rhetoric that you later probably think to yourself, that was harsh. And I just wonder, to some extent, if it's just not taking a deep breath and realizing you're in a different place. And that's about the most benign interpretation I put on it.
That's being charitable. That's being charitable. And it could be an accurate assessment. But if you're going to win this race, and you believe you're going to win this race by 50.02%, you've got to serve all of Georgia. And if you're going to stand up there and call Stacey Abrams all the names that he's calling her and her supporters, i.e. me, names, how do you communicate to me in any way that you care about the 49.8% of Georgian that you are disparaging and insulting on an hourly basis?
All right. Go ahead.
I just want to say, too, that we cannot separate the fact that Brian Kemp, as Secretary of State, has had Stacey really biting at him. And I don't mean that. I mean, they've been combative for a very long time.
For years.
Right, for years. And so Brian is, you know, he's a human being, and perhaps he's showing a little frustration.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, Kemp himself has said none of these things. I may have missed them. These are all coming from his staff. Just to be clear.
And that's why his comment about the, quote, ridiculous lawsuits.
Well, yeah, that was the one time he did say something.
That's what I heard that.
All right. You're right.
He's been living with that for so long, and he's feeling like, okay, can we move on and not be about the lawsuits now, be about the results?
Right. I think you're very right, and I think Governor Sonny Perdue had a similar attitude about lawyers and lawsuits. Brian Kemp has been in litigation for years. He's losing every lawsuit, and he's losing all the new lawsuits, right, and he's upset.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt because I'm running really late to get to our first break of the show. Let's do that right now, and we'll come back with more on Political Rewind.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Jim Galloway, you've picked up a new fan on Facebook Live. Her name is Aaliyah or Alia Smith. She thinks you're a political ninja.
Yes, that's good.
I think you're right. I think he is.
I don't think I'm nimble at all.
All right. We've got another race that we're watching very closely right now, and that's the, Jim, the 7th District Congressional race, where incumbent Rob Woodall is about 900 votes ahead of Democratic challenger Carolyn Bordeaux. She filed lawsuit this morning, which is much like the others we've talked about. It's like essentially make sure every vote gets counted before we certify the election in Gwinnett County, where the treasure trove of votes for her would come in.
So, and I think she expressed some of the same doubts about the absentee ballots and the signature issues that the Democratic Party has already brought up.
Exactly. So, what do we think about her ability? I mean, 900 votes, Kyle. 900 votes, 10,000 votes in the case of Abrams trying to get to a runoff. I know they sound like that's not a lot, but the reality is those are a lot of votes to make up in an election. I'm not even quite sure what my question is, other than to say that sometimes we look at numbers like that and think it's no big deal, but it is a big deal to make up even 900 votes, yeah?
It is. I mean, you have to, if you're Carolyn Bordeaux, I think you have to hope that the votes that haven't come in are from areas that have supported you really heavily, because you have to make up that ground really quickly when there's a small number of votes left. I think for the Republicans, though, regardless of whether or not the outcome of the 7th changes from where we think it is now, the damage may have been done to suburban Republicans on the state level who lost state legislative races.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. We're going to get into that in a lot more detail in a couple minutes. Before we do, Carolyn Bordeaux had a news conference this morning after her team filed their lawsuit. And this is a very small excerpt from what she said, but it explains why she's doing it.
Gwinnett's refusal to count every eligible voter's ballot, whether intentionally or not, does constitute a form of voter suppression. And we are demanding that the votes be counted in the 7th District.
Mary Margaret, voter suppression, they may end up being two of the most important words in Georgia in all of 2018.
Voter suppression is a political message, but it is also a legal reality. And I have been in the weeds of much of the legislation brought forward by the Republican administration and the Government Affairs Committee of the House, and there's always an effort to create new barriers on the theory, on the message that there's voter fraud. Gwinnett County is ground central for all of these litigations. The growth of the county, the diversity of the county, the changing law, the changing rules, the changing population, all have made it hard on them, and they have to be close to perfect.
Let me ask you, Mary Margaret, back in the late 1990s, when Democrats saw the surge of Republicans coming up, they did their own statutory work in the legislature to set up barriers that would make it just a little bit harder for Republicans to claim equality in the Capitol. What is your feeling when you see a group in power threatened? In my experience, the threatened power starts to act. They start to create new barriers. Should we be looking for that in January?
I'll be very interested to see what tactics are brought forward in 2019. I mean, one of the things that Trump said this week is early voting is ridiculous, or whoever said that. I mean, every year they try to limit early voting. Well, most of Georgians are voting early now. They like it. And it suits them, and it allows them to vote more often.
And so far as we know, it doesn't have a partisan cast anymore.
I have never heard anybody tell me it has a partisan cast. I missed all the Roy Barnes years as governor. Those were my gap years. I was away, you know, practicing law, out of politics. But clearly the political maps that Roy Barnes and the Democrats drafted for the 2002 elections after reapportionment when they were in charge, I'm one of the people that benefited. The multi-member districts gave me a chance to come back and run again. So people in power will like to stay in power, and that's a reality that I accept in my political life. The question is, are they keeping in power by illegalities, intentional or malfeasance? And nonfeasance or malfeasance? And I think Brian Kemp's Republican leadership has intentionally nonfeasance and malfeasance have impacted voter participation.
You know, I have irritated any number of our listeners because I've said on a number of occasions we see clear patterns that you're describing, which make a suggestion that there have been efforts to limit voters. And we certainly know that things like photo ID, that exact match, while Republicans call those voter security measures, Democrats call them voter suppression in efforts to narrow the group of people who are allowed to vote. But Mary Margaret, is there a smoking gun? We don't have a memo in which we have the Secretary of State saying to a county election official in a county in South Georgia, here's what you need to do to make sure that the Democrats don't get out to vote.
There's some depositions I'd like to take about backroom discussions.
Okay.
But I don't know if there's a written smoking gun from a Secretary of State to an elected official. The voter ID thing, do we want to rehash that?
No.
Okay.
Except that we know, what I'm saying is, we know that Republicans do those things, Jim, saying that they are efforts at voter security.
Yes, but they're not looking at John Doe or Jane Smith and saying, no, you can't vote. What's happening in a lot of these cases is statistical point shaving.
Yes. Okay.
And that's you're going after a 10th or a 20th percent of the population, and using that to benefit the end results.
All right.
And look, and even if that does matter, which I'm not saying, look, I think sometimes people engage in electioneering without intending harm, but really truly believing that voter ID is a good idea, just for the sake of the idea. And if some people lose in the process of that, then those people who feel like those people will be disenfranchised should look for a way to make sure they got IDs. I mean, that's a very pragmatic, practical way of looking at it without saying that that's some kind of malfeasance is taking place. And I think we need to be fair about it.
All right. I'd love to move on. Obviously, we're going to keep track of what's happening in the governor's race. We'll watch the 7th district race as we move forward. I want to talk for a few minutes. Kyle, I want to get you into this conversation. We're starting to really get good information about who voted and why, and we'll have more, especially in the state of Georgia, in the days and weeks ahead on all of that. But exit poll data has been really fascinating. The national exit poll data shows that women voted for Democrats by one of the biggest margins ever over Republicans. 59% of women voted for Democrats, 40% voted for Republicans, a margin of 19% or 19 points, which is nearly double the margin by which they voted for Democrats in 2016. So on a national level, we are now seeing that women, perhaps because of Trump's behavior, his comments, have really moved into the Democratic sphere.
Yeah, and I also think part of it is that there were many more women running for office this election. And so many women who wanted to vote for somebody who looked like them or who had life experiences like theirs went to their ballot and found women on that ballot. Many of them were Democrats, and over 100 women are going to be serving in the U.S. House of Representatives this fall.
All right. But Mary Margaret, you can then break things down a little bit. Let's go to the state of Georgia alone. Now, I'm looking at CNN exit poll data on that because, again, we don't have the Secretary of State's numbers yet on exact numbers. Here in Georgia, the gap between we have women voted for Abrams 51% 49%, only a 2-point advantage. And white women voted for Kemp 75%.
I don't happen to believe that number.
You don't believe the CNN's right on that?
I don't think it's right for Georgia. I mean, you had too many wins in the Northern Arc, what Jim Galloway highlighted for us last week, 2 weeks ago. Women winning up there, beating established Republicans, it makes no sense at all that those women voted. It's not statistically correct.
So you take issue with the fact, with what their suggestion is that 75% of white women in Georgia voted for Kemp over.
That's a good bit more than white women who voted for Trump, and I think those numbers were accurate.
Okay.
But I don't believe that number. It makes no sense when you put together these election wins for all the women in the Northern suburbs.
I get that. Jim, but we don't take issue with the fact that the margin between Kemp and Abrams among women was much, much narrower than the national polling showed.
No, but the geographic spread of that might have been a little bit different. I think you probably saw, in fact, I'm sure you saw female support for Kemp less in the suburbs than you might in areas
right,
of rural Georgia.
Right. So that brings us to just that question, Jim. Newt Gingrich.
Oh, yeah.
and who else was it that got
it? It was Karl Rove.
Oh, Karl Rove. Both decided that it was time to play armchair quarterback with Brian Kemp's campaign. What did they say about his race?
But basically, they took a look at Brian Kemp, who's essentially running the Sonny Perdue Donald Trump play of going into rural Georgia, jacking up the vote as much as possible, depending on exurbia as well, neglecting suburbia. And in order to pull out a win, and this is what Kemp has apparently done. I mean, we'll see whether it holds up, but that's what he's got right now. And Gingrich was just, you got to remember, Gingrich was kind of the first famous occupant of the 6th district.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's now being represented by a Democratic African American mom. and it didn't go over well with the former speaker. He was out there this weekend over on the coast. I don't know what the political occasion was, but the Washington Examiner picked it up. And he does not like this strategy of ignoring the suburbs. He thinks it's quite dangerous for Republicans.
Leo, what do you think about that?
I mean, I think the strategy to ignore the suburbs started when the new figure that is the iconic leader of the Republican Party used the strategy that pulled out rural voters. And I think all state party chairmen now are sort of maybe yielding. I've spoken directly to John Watson, but I would think that the strategy is, Trump is driving a base in South Georgia in different places, people who haven't always been involved in politics, and he won a presidential election using that method. It is a somewhat cost-effective, less engaging way of doing politics, but it works. And I think you saw that. And it not only hurt the Republicans in a way or challenged us in a great way, it challenged us because the people that he's pulled out in South Georgia require entertainment. And so you saw Trump come to town doing a key aspect of Kern Handel's race. And I can't imagine that Kern was all too happy that they had a big, huge rally down south that pulled everybody from door knocking to a rally down south when we needed people actually in the 6th District and 7th District knocking on doors.
Brian Kemp is 20 years about younger than Donald Trump. He has these three young teenage daughters that he promotes, and they're lovely, and I'm sure it's a really lovely family. He made a strategic decision to have a political ad pointing a gun at a teenager and making a joke about his daughter's boyfriend, and a strategic decision to say in front of his big silver truck, bulldog, truck, to go around picking up illegals. That had an impact on the suburbs. And I don't know how he backs away from that. I don't know if he wants to back away from that.
Well, I'm saying strategically, it may not have been a bad move from an electioneering
primary. It won him the primary. Many people will concede, and I'm not an expert on Republican primary. But now he's continuing this name-calling and this... Does he want to be a preppy Lester Maddox? Is that his strategy?
Well, I don't think so. But let me, if I could, the one thing, if I could just pick up on Newt Gingrich's thought here. And the one thing that has been reliable about the Republican vote is that they come out for runoffs. These are suburban voters who are coming out for runoffs, and they're older suburban voters. And the voters that Brian Kemp was after, he was kind of the mirror image of Stacey Abrams. He was after those white rural voters who don't always turn out, mm-hmm. right? Who need Donald Trump to stir them up. Okay. Do you go back to those voters in a runoff, Or do you try to win back the Republican suburban? I think it might have changed the dynamic of statewide runoffs.
Well,
I'm not sure.
And we're going to talk about just that in a minute. But before we do, Mary Margaret, I want to drill down on something with you, if I may. Because you've had hard words today for Kemp, who may very well be the next governor. And what I think about when I hear you make those comments is how many times on this show you have talked about your ability to work in a very positive way with Governor Deal and how much you have respected a lot of his agenda. So you'll work across the aisle. Are you concerned about being able to continue that with Brian Kemp if he's the governor?
I think you've asked a really good question. I don't know what Brian Kemp's issues will be. I don't know how he will behave. I've never seen him, you know, except for that weirdness about being snarky about the ridiculous lawsuits, I've never seen him act badly in public. So I'm kind of weirdly, what is going to happen here? Is he going to continue this persona, or is he going to try to make himself, as he's suggested in some political positions, more like Nathan Deal?
Yeah, but so Kyle, you're the youngest of all of us on this panel today, so maybe you're the wrong guy to ask this of. But as I pointed out, I think on a show late last week, early on in his tenure, Nathan Deal was a pretty he had taken on some positions that a Mary Margaret Oliver would not have approved of. His fight for immigration restrictions was one that conservatives loved, but that more liberal policymakers and legislators didn't like very much. Mary Margaret's grimacing as I say this, but early on in the administration, we didn't know where Deal was coming from either, did we?
Well, his political ads on immigration were what they were, but I never saw him. The Medicaid issue is fundamental to Georgia's health as we move forward. Nathan Deal made a mistake in that, and how does Brian Kemp recover?
Kyle, jump in.
It will depend, I think, on who he legislates for. If he takes up immigration measures similar to Governor Deal's early years, then I think it is going to be hard for him to find common ground with Democrats. But I think if you're looking to rural Georgia, and he amped up the vote in rural Georgia, Medicaid expansion or dealing with the rural health crisis is something that I don't know how that could not be on his plate in some form or fashion. And that's where he may find common ground with the Democrats. But that's going to require him to be a very different governor than he was as a candidate, particularly in the primary. And I'm with Mary Margaret in that I think it's hard for us to tell where he's going to be.
Yeah.
It's just he wasn't very clear in the race about where he stands.
All right, we got to get our last break of the show out of the way. Let's do that, and we'll be right back.
You may think you're alone at home, but
every surface, every bit of air, every bit of water in your home is alive.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with scientist Rob Dunn about the microbes, fungi, bacteria, bugs, and more that inhabit our homes. He says the average house has thousands of species in it. His new book is Never Home Alone. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and gpbnews.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Kyle Hayes joins us from NPR Studios in Washington. Leo Smith is here, Mary Margaret Oliver, and of course, Jim Galloway is with us. We're running a little short on time, but Jim, here's something we didn't get to talk about because of all the concern about who's won which election. Here's an election that was resolved that we didn't talk about last week. Stockbridge did not lose a portion of its city to an entity that was going to be called Eagles Landing. In fact, it wasn't even close.
No. There were two voter questions that were presented to Henry County voters, specific sectors of Henry County voters, and they both failed after this humongous effort in the legislature to ram this sucker through. After the governor signed it to the surprise of more than one or two people.
Let's make one thing clear to our listeners who may not have been paying the kind of attention that some of us in this room have. The reason this matters more than just being a local issue is that we certainly see many examples in Georgia in the last couple of decades of unincorporated areas or areas of a county breaking off and forming their own city. South Fulton did that last year. We've seen any number of examples. We've got Stonecrest out in DeKalb County. But this was an effort to take a city and break off from a city itself. Very different.
Right. Roughly half the tax base of Stockbridge would have been withdrawn from that city and combined with acreage from unincorporated Henry County to form the city of Eagles Landing.
And Mary Margaret, you would have seen Buckhead try to secede from Atlanta if it had passed.
There was
perhaps
already extensive discussion around Buckhead in Brookhaven. It was a fascinatingly unprecedented financially risky move. The bond lawyers are a pretty important group in this state, and the bond lawyers came out who'd bonded debt for Stockbridge and said pretty clearly, this is a bad idea. I expected the political blood and the political anger and the political fight over this measure. I never understood why they thought this was doable ultimately. I expected the governor to veto it when he didn't. I expected the court to throw it out. I'm very happy that the voters woke up and said, this is bad business.
You've got Henry County rapidly changing in its population from white to African American. And you've also, so there was that element. This was pushed through by two of the remaining white legislators remaining in Henry with Cotton Henry County. So there's the element of this had to be done before the change became too great. And then in the very last weeks before the vote on Tuesday, a court case involving some of these bond attorneys that you were talking about, Mary and Margaret, it came out that all along, this is a fact that had been kind of hidden by Eagles Landing and by the Stockbridge people alone, that there would have been a division of the debt that Stockbridge carries, that Eagles Landing would have carried half the debt that stock would have been saddled with that. And I think that probably killed it within the gated community set.
Yeah, it was a total misjudgment to try to bring this forward on financial, legal, political basis.
I think it was more about the debt and not about the changing demographics so much, because when I look at what Leon Stafford pointed out, that, you know, it still would have been a majority black city even when they finished it. So I think it was less about the demographics, more about the economics. And though it's not the same sort of...
It was class.
It was class. And the same thing in Stockbridge. The city of Stockbridge was also about class. It's mostly African Americans who are economically more wealthy and more educated. And this is, we don't want to have anything to do with Lithonia. Same stuff.
Speaking of changes in Henry County, Leon Stafford, one of your colleagues at the AJC, had a terrific piece this morning on a woman who won a seat on the Henry County Commission. For Vivian Thomas, she tells the story that when she was living down in South Georgia, where she was from, and was on her way to Georgia State University in the late 70s, her dad said to her, do not stop in Henry County, young lady. Do not. Don't stop for gas. Don't stop for food. Go through, because he was concerned about the racial problems he thought she might face as an African-American. And 40 years later, she is on the Henry County Commission as one of their new African American commissioners.
America the Beautiful.
Yeah, you got to remember that Stockbridge was the ancestral home of Martin Luther King Sr.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting to point that out. All right, with just a couple minutes left, Jim, I want to start with you, and then Kyle, I want to get you in the mix on this. Galloway, we have been, those of us who cover politics, have cared about politics, we have been waiting for a presidential election cycle where Georgia matters. You think it's going to be 2020, and you think the evidence comes out of the what you saw in the vote last week.
Yeah, I know we've said this before. but here, look at this. Look at this. The results of the governor's race matter. Right now, Brian Kemp is sitting at 50.27% of the total popular vote of a population that's not too far off from a presidential population. Almost 4 million voted. So you've got the dynamic there. You've got the shifting suburbs in a single media market that can be got at with one or two TV stations.
Right.
And you've got a dynamic Democratic leader now in Abrams, who could be a rallying point. And you've got a 2020 U.S. Senate race with David Perdue.
You do. Yes. Kyle, I don't want to put words into Jim's mouth because he didn't say this part of it. But now that we've seen that Wisconsin can be a Democratic state after the election results we've seen with Scott Walker losing, Pennsylvania returned some seats to Democrats. Michigan did. Ohio seems like a lost cause. I mean, it may or may not ever be the great swing state it has been. But what Galloway points out, Kyle, is that there might be a play for Georgia, given the electoral map as it changes.
Well, and I think part of it's going to depend on who the Democratic nominee ultimately is. And I bet this is an issue in that primary, sort of a progressive, true-to-their-values candidate. Somebody maybe like Kamala Harris or Cory Booker might look to the South, might look to Georgia and another state like Texas as a potential Republic flip from the Republicans. If you get a nominee that's based out of the Midwest, somebody like Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, who maybe could turn that back into a competitive state, or Amy Klobuchar in Minnesota, you may look for that Democratic path to 270 to go through the Midwest instead. So I think it's going to depend a little bit on who the nominee is and where they focus their efforts on finding 270 electoral votes.
I also think it also depends on this test marketing that Stacey and the law group is doing, because I think they're testing for soft spots in judgeships. How do judges feel about election law? And I think they're trying to reshape the discussion in a large way, and that's going to impact 2020 as well.
We're almost out of time. We'll keep this discussion going because the next election's only right around the corner is when you're covering elections, Jim. Mary Margaret, you got to go into special session tomorrow. Are you ready for it?
No. I'm not ready, but I'll be there and try to understand the issues the governor wants us to consider.
How difficult is it going to be for the governor to get what he wants out of this session, among other things, the Delta fuel tax, the $40 million fuel tax, which he created an executive order around but now needs a legislative approval on?
Has to have legislative approval. The Delta has not been paying its taxes since the executive order. I think it's going to be dicey. I'm hearing some rumblings. I do think he'll get the storm damage money. The devastation to Southwest Georgia and South Georgia is extreme and needs remedy.
All right. How many days are we going to be there, Mary Margaret? Give us a prediction.
5. You only have to do 5 to pass a bill. So I think we'll wrap up on Saturday. I haven't heard that confirmed, but I expect it not to go into Thanksgiving week.
All right. Well, we wish you good luck.
And we have caucus elections, Senate, House, Republican, Democrat, which always adds some drama.
All right, Mary Margaret Oliver, we look forward to hearing how things develop for you down under the Gold Dome as the special session begins tomorrow. We'll be talking about it on tomorrow's show, so stay with us for that tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Leo Smith, thank you so much for being here. Kyle Hayes, it's always fun to have you on from the nation's capital. Come on back and be in the studio with us. We liked having you here.
Yeah, I'd love to.
All right. And Jim Galloway, we'll see you again. See you on Friday for
Absolutely.
A Political Rewind. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again tomorrow at 2.